War is over. If the Cold War was not over, some of these things you still wouldn't be learning. For instance, the Italian government also, at the very top levels, into the 1990s, was staffed by people who were former fascists. Yeah, and they had in their coalitions people who were former fascists. Now, why did that happen? Well, the Cold War, it takes some explanation, but basically the United States sided with anybody in Europe who was against the Soviet Union, and that included the former Nazis. Okay, so that stuff's starting to creep out, but I want to come back to my original point. My original point was that at the time, you have to remember, in the 30s and 40s, fascism was popular in Europe. Okay, it took 27 million Russian lives to exterminate, to make this idea unpopular, so that some of us don't even know what it is, right, I'm sure. But at the time, it was very popular, and to get to how Russia went from being the wimp of Europe to being able to beat the Germans pretty much single-handedly has to do with industrialization, has to do with Stalin, has to do with Marxism, and that's Stalin's accomplishment. Now, I want to come back to that's it I'm going to say about accomplishments. That took me a lot longer than I thought. But one drawback, I can boil it down to one sentence, is that he had an inadequate concept of class struggle. Now, what does that mean? It means he was purging, and this is admitted by his second or third in command after Stalin died. He was purging. He was killing off his enemies through this whole time, not so much around 1924, not in the 1920s. Things were fairly easy going then. But in the 30s and the 40s, especially in the 30s, he was killing off his internal enemies, and they kept reappearing. Now, the problem with Stalin's idea about this, as summed up by Bukharin, we have to give Bukharin credit on this one point. Now, I'm going to point to this guy. That's how you spell his name. Bukharin was wrong about most things, in our opinion, but this one thing he got right. He said that, according to Stalin's strange conception of class struggle, the class struggle intensifies the further socialism goes along. And, in fact, it intensifies and becomes more violent, just as the bourgeoisie is wiped out. Because according to Stalin, there's no longer an internal class. There is no bourgeoisie. There are no landlords anymore. So this was Stalin's conception that they have socialism now. There is no landlord class. There is no bourgeoisie anymore. Yet, all these people still had to be killed. He was finding all these enemies. So something was, something's not together. And later Mao put this together and he said, no, there is. There is an internal enemy that continues to exist even under socialism. This is an argument we can have later. And there, the bourgeoisie, the new exploiter class, arises right in the Communist Party itself because it has access to the means of production. Okay, so this is, when it comes to Stalin, he would keep killing people off who were enemies. And in the main, we think he did hit the right people. Now that's controversial, deservedly so. But he didn't have any idea how to keep the enemies from arising in the first place. This was more Mao's idea in the Cultural Revolution, was what things you have to do under socialism and economic organization to prevent a bourgeoisie from arising in the first place in the party, to whatever extent you can. So that's, to boil it all down, in our opinion, what his drawback was, is that there's no bourgeoisie, according to Stalin, anymore under socialism. Now how does this, I'm going to relate this to all this over here. I'm boiling all this down very simplistically. It's hard, but these three graphs over here are basically all the same thing. The idea of a U-curve is actually pretty important in the way we communists think. Just to take this one. Gandhi liberated India in 1947, or he was a leader in the movement. I don't know if you can say he liberated it. Everybody knows he was a pacifist. He was for nonviolence. Did not organize armies to kill off the English to get them out. But India continued to suffer from starvation. And where it started out ahead of China in life expectancy, when they were liberated, they fell behind. Why? Mao used violence against the landlord classes against the occupiers. And he installed collective agriculture. And now, after a few years, China isn't behind India anymore. Why? Because peasants aren't starving to death. That's the bottom line. Starving to death. To this day, in India and pretty much the rest of the subcontinent, millions of children are starving to death each year. And that adds up very quickly to more than war. This is something that I myself, you know, was surprised to find out when I was studying the causes of violence and what I was going to do with my life. I thought, you know, probably war was a good place to start, you know, figure out what the causes of war are and why this evil comes about. Turns out, war doesn't add up nearly as quickly as starving peasants, if you want to count the dead bodies. Okay, so let me back up. These curves, I'm telling you, yeah, Mao used more violence. Okay, Gandhi hardly used any. He didn't use any. There was a rebellion within military units in India. But he's famous for this. But the landlord stayed in power. So he wasn't actively shooting people, but he was letting people starve. We would say that people have an ethical responsibility to each other. If people are starving to death, and that starvation is preventable, then that's no different than being shot to death. We count that as violence. That's how we look at it. A lot of people don't. Now let me get into that's exactly where we're going to start to separate from, well, the predominant point of view in the United States would be some kind of Christian idea, right? Well, the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill. Well, it's only 10 of 8. You might as well go home, because if you're a Christian, there's nothing I can say to you. I mean, if you're really hardcore believe that thou shalt not kill is what God said, and if I don't do what God said, I'm going to hell, or if there's no hell, I should go to heaven, at least by carrying this out, I can't argue. If you're right, you're right. Okay, there's nothing we Stalinists can say to you. If it's thou shalt not kill, there's no doubt Stalin was bad. He killed. Okay, so the question is, from our point of view as Marxists, we call it idealism. The afterlife idea, God, Christianity, that's idealism. Trotskyism is another kind of idealism for the most part. Why? Because they're not telling us about things that were actually possible in the real world. In fact, a real Christian will say, well, even if I could save someone, I will not kill someone. If I could save 2 people, if I could save 10 people, I will not kill someone because it's what? Thou shalt not kill, right? And when I put a graph like this and start talking about the numbers of people who die, you're going to hear someone say, either thou shalt not kill, that's one of them. The other one you hear a lot is, ends don't justify the means, right? Which is another way of saying, don't calculate it out. You should have principles against violence. And therefore, Stalin was bad because he was violent. Well, we're not going to deny Stalin was violent. So it really does come down to this question. Are you living in this world, and do you concern yourself with this world, or are you more concerned with your afterlife? Now, there are a lot of idealists who don't realize that they think the way Christians do. Most academics, in fact, think the way Christians do unconsciously. But unless you can show a choice that was less violent, and you can show us how it would have worked, we're not going to be persuaded. So we're not going to hear it when you say the ends don't justify the means. No. Because we know that if Stalin hadn't slave-drived the Soviet Union the way he did, they would have lost. Because you just saw that map I handed around, okay? Hitler, even though Stalin, you know, drove the Russian people into the ground, drove the Soviet peoples into the ground to make them industrialize, Hitler still almost won the war. And let me tell you a few things. When they got to Stalingrad, the Germans held most of Stalingrad. When they came, they bombed it to smithereens, and the troops came in. The Russians held part of one hill on the river. Okay, you saw the river that's kind of separating European Soviet Union from the rest of Asia, which is very sparsely populated, right? The Russians held part of one hill and a pocket here and there. Most of Stalingrad was occupied by the Germans. The Germans almost, they came very close to winning that battle. That's what I'm here to tell you. Okay? And it's so obvious to people who know this history that even Gorbachev, you know, who obviously hated Stalin, you know, and was the great hero of the United States, even he, when he had a review done of this question, didn't believe that there was any option like what Bukharin was saying or other people were saying when it came to World War II. He did not even believe that, because it was that close. If you had slowed down the pace, if you'd say, okay, let's go a more relaxed pace to industrialization, let's not kill off people who make mistakes, let's not kill off people who aren't, you know, gung-ho enough, let's not kill off people who are sowing intellectual doubt. You know, Trotsky being the number one intellectual doubter who said, who predicted that Stalin would lose World War II, who predicted this openly throughout the 30s. Let's not kill off those kind of people. This was not a choice that the Soviets had. They almost lost it. They gave up 27 million people and still just barely won that war. That's what you need to understand. So, returning to this question of the grass, why I did this, it's a question of reality. You know, it's like if you go see the movie Matrix, you get to pick the red pill or the blue pill. Okay, taking the red pill is not pleasant. This is not pleasant at all if you go see this movie. But it's the truth. Okay, now I'm telling you, that from our point of view, the truth involves mostly a description of how much violence and death there's going to be given certain paths. We're saying we can prove that there's more violence and death because of the road Gandhi took. We're saying there would have been more violence and death if Bukharin had his way. Bukharin did not want to force collectivized agriculture, although he admitted he was wrong later, but in the 20s, late 20s, early 30s, he did not want this to happen. He did not want so many people executed for getting confused and screwing up industrialization, or for being saboteurs. They were called wreckers, of which anti-communists from the United States did in fact witness. There's books published about this, people who were wrecking Soviet industry. Bukharin wanted a more laid-back approach. Not a lot more, but significantly more. And even Gorbachev felt, you know, after reviewing the history, this was not an option. Bukharin was one of the major leaders in the Soviet Communist Party, and that was his plan. And the Central Committee rejected it. They picked Stalin. Trotsky's was another plan we can talk about. Probably some of you had something to say about that. I think I'll skip over this for a while. We can come back. This is something, another graph here, that concerns Stalin at the end of his life in 1952. He wrote a book about this. The leaders that came after him, Molotov, for instance, admitted he didn't really fully understand these issues, and that's why he kind of needed Stalin around. So when Stalin died, he wasn't able to handle it. Khrushchev also didn't understand the basic Marxist theory behind the so-called law of value, although it's very central to Marxist theory. Well, maybe we can get to that later. I want to get into the national question, because that's how we build this talk, talking about, you know, why is it that people who were contemporaries or even a generation after Stalin supported him, people like Paul Robeson, Dubois, here, of course, you know about him. Liu Shan, the greatest modern Chinese writer in history, was a supporter of Stalin. In fact, he wrote polemics against Trotskyists in China, saying exactly what I was telling you about religion and idealism. He was saying, I'm afraid you look so lustily into the sky that you will fall flat on the ground. In other words, he's telling the Trotskyists to get over their religious inclinations and deal with the reality as it faced them. The Black Panther Party, David Hilliard was chief of staff, and he, in that party of the 60s, he had posters down on his wall. Huey Newton was a big supporter of Stalin and Mao, of course. Mao Zedong was his most important descendant, ideologically speaking. And Mao Zedong, in turn, influenced a lot of people because he liberated China by force in 1949, kicking the Japanese out first and then fighting U.S.-backed puppets. But that was very influential in how to decolonize throughout Africa and Asia. So in the 60s, you saw all these armed struggles arise throughout those third world countries, pretty much following in Mao's footsteps. and liberating country after country from colonialism. So you hear this decolonization. Now, the connection of Stalin to all that starts in 1913, where he publishes his pretty much his only major theoretical work that he's known for, that Lenin asked him to do, which is Marxism and the National Question. So it was Stalin's job. Lenin said, this is your job. Go write us our platform on the National Question. What are we going to do about oppressions of nations by other nations? And Stalin, to make a long story short, said that we communists, well, we have this job of ending the oppression of small nations by bigger and more powerful nations, but we also want to use nationalism in a progressive direction that can be a solution, a communist solution of cooperation for the whole world. So we're not just nationalists of the oppressed nations. We're not just for the liberation of small nations, but we want to do it in such a way that it will contribute to global economic cooperation, the communist solution. So he wrote this essay, and I'll just quote one thing from it. This is pretty famous. You hear it quoted again and again by various organizations. A nation is a historically constituted, stable community of people formed on the basis of a common language, territory, economic life, and psychological makeup manifested in a common culture. So it was four things. Having a common language, common territory, economic intercourse, trade amongst yourselves, and culture, or psychological makeup, four things. And he said, if you have these things, then you're going to have a force at work called the nation, a force that we have to account for in our calculations, because we are trying to figure out the way forward to a cooperative economic future, a one with less violence. And we have to account for this factor. And it's not something religious or as a matter of high-sounding principle, capital P, or God. It's just, if you have those four things together in history, Stalin claims that there's going to be a force involved, and you're going to have to deal with it. And we should deal with it in such a way that it contributes to liberation. So, that's just theory. In actuality, Stalin was more known for being the applicator, the person who was most trusted to apply Lenin's thought. And that's what he claimed to be. And frankly, his critics would also say that, you know, he was not very original. This was criticism. So he was more or less trusted by the majority. Even before they came to power, he got the highest number of votes to be on the newspaper central committee. So he was trusted as someone who would apply things more than as someone who would come up with entirely new theories. So his influence through the national liberation struggles up to the present day comes from the things I was already talking about. Number one was development. He showed that a country could develop without slavery, without taking over other countries, without setting up some kind of tribute system so that, you know, well, you, this country over here, you have to send me so much tax dollars a year. None of that. Stalin showed this could be done in 10 or 15 years. It was brutal, but he showed it could be done very quickly. And this was something that all third world peoples after World War II had in mind. They didn't, you know, colonialism of other countries wasn't an option. Taking hundreds of millions or tens of millions of slaves from some other country was not an option. So building up your wealth, how to do it. Stalin seemed like the fastest, the best, the most just example in history thus far. That's one reason. So people like Liu Shan and Mao Zedong looked up to him. In addition to this, I mean, yeah, he wrote the theory question. Another reason I also touched on already is that because he shared a lot in common with Mao, and he was actively involved as a practitioner of national liberation struggle. In fact, he turned the whole communist movement to the east, we said. Because if you know the history of the communist movement, in the teens and the 1920s, even Lenin and people like Trotsky, most of the famous communists were in Europe. And they thought there was a good chance, and they were right. They thought Germany would go down for a communist revolution, and it came really close in 1923. Didn't happen. But at the time, everybody, because of the millions of people who belonged to communist clubs in Germany, and because of the horrors of the World War I, a lot of people thought Europe was going to go for it. Starting with Russia, there was an aborted revolution in Hungary. But Germany came close, and if Germany had gone communist, then it's very possible you would have seen a domino effect through Europe. And that's what most kind of communists of that time and earlier were thinking. It was very Europe-centered. And with Stalin and Lenin in his later life, starting in the 20s, Lenin starts to worry that it may not happen in Europe and we may have to hold out for a while and wait. Starting with Stalin, there's more attention to the East, to China, to the colonies, to places where it was supposedly backward, where the working class was supposedly not advanced enough. So the Marxist theory starts to undergo an evolution, and Stalin was a major player in this. Lenin was pushing already in this direction in the last couple of years of his life. But it was Stalin who, you probably already heard this before, he was the one who instigated this idea of socialism in one country, right? He has some quotes from Lenin, but he was known for upholding this idea against Trotsky. And this, again, kind of pushed in the national liberation direction, where nationalists could say, yes, I don't have to wait for the Europeans to come to the communist idea. I don't have to wait for the Germans. It's not going to be the superior scientifically intelligent workers of Britain or the United States bringing communism to me. Me, I in the third world, I can make socialism in my country. Okay, so Stalin was a large subjective factor behind why this communist movement changed directions that way. Because it was mostly, let's be truthful, it was mostly a white man's thing up to that point. Even though it obviously had a lot of application elsewhere. But Stalin starts changing the direction, and you get Mao, and you start to develop these theories. One of the key theories, the theory of the principal contradiction, which we talk about a lot. Today we say the principal contradiction is between the oppressed nations and imperialism. Imperialism being led by the United States. And it was Stalin who really put this theory out first. He was the one saying, well, it didn't work out the way we planned. Germany didn't go down. The advanced, scientifically most modern workers didn't do it. The weak link of capitalism and imperialism turns out to be in the third world, or the agrarian countries. You call it the weak link. He said, if you grasp this weak link as strongly as you can and you pull on it with all our communist might, if we focus our communist energies there, we will break this link and we will shatter capital. So Russia went first, and he believed China could go, a number of other colonies too. So the colonies might actually go first. And he theorized what stages the revolution would have to go through, and that was controversial and so on. But they said, principal contradiction is the one, out of all the struggles you pick, out of all the fights you want to pick, he says, pick the fight where if you win it by grasping with all your might, you're going to advance all the other struggles the most. And he said it, he was the one who said the national liberation struggle might be the principal contradiction. So this idea started to come out. And that, to get to that point, Marxism kind of had to go through this theoretical switch, where before you kind of had a global capitalist class fighting a global proletariat. And to schematize it, we still do accuse the Trotskyists of thinking you have to have a simultaneous revolution of the whole global proletariat against the whole global ruling class. And that idea went out with Stalin, and you started breaking it into pieces, into countries. He says, well, maybe this proletariat in this country can win and knock over the ruling class. And when it gets in power, maybe it can even ally with some of the ruling classes of other countries, as we did in World War II, for instance, like the Soviet Union allied with England and France to deal with Germany, right? So this thing, once you go to this one country at a time formulation, kind of changes all of Marxist theory, or at least makes clear what was already there if you read some of the things that Marx had said about Ireland, for instance. Now you have one country flipping over at a time, maybe over here another one, proletariat comes into power. And the theory is that this can go on and on, and imperialism will be weakened that way, one country at a time. And so becomes an obvious role for national liberation struggles within that. Says, well, we can actually ally with the bourgeoisie to knock out the imperialists, because the bourgeoisie has an interest in coming to power and knocking out the imperialists. Why? Because the capitalists are divided. Each capitalist wants to be the exploiter his or herself. Microsoft's going at it with Apple. That's no longer anymore, right? But, you know, Burger King is fighting with McDonald's. Okay, on a national scale or international scale, the same thing is happening. my country's capitalists want to ice out the other country's capitalists for the business, whether that be profits, imports, resources. And Lenin and Stalin, but Stalin in particular, who applied this the most, said we could take advantage of that. We can take advantage of those divisions. We can take advantage of the division between Germany and England. Germany wanted England's colonies. We can take advantage of that. We can side with part of the bourgeoisie, in essence, part of the capitalist class, because there are national struggles going on. That just means that there are different class struggles. It's not a class struggle on the whole world plane, you know, ruling class on the top and the proletariat and the peasants on the bottom. That's a very simplistic view. Stalin says it's more complicated than that. We have to understand the national question. We have to look at class struggles in each country. It's not that we're against class struggle now. It's that we think different class struggles are important than what we used to think. Okay, we can ally with certain classes, and we'll still be engaged in class struggles, and we're still trying to get the classes on the bottom on top. But it's not a simple simultaneous thing where the bottom allies against the top. Okay, so that's Stalin's contribution, and by being industrializing and becoming powerful, he was the one who made that happen. So we have decolonization that followed a number of countries looking to the Soviet Union as a way to develop. Okay, I'm gonna stop there. I think this is probably a good time to. I'm sure I said enough controversial things. Why don't we enter into, I know we have some argument coming up.